got this recording, that's recording. Andy, we are up. Thanks for being here. How's it going, man?
How you doing?
Doing good, man. And so one thing, you know, when I read your stuff and your biography, whatever you want to say, you were, it seemed like you had a very interesting background. And just so everyone kind of knows what we're kind of, we're going to get into here. You know, you've written for Rolling Stone, ESPN, Forbes, you've interviewed a bunch of different rock stars and it seems like celebrity sports stars and everything. Just maybe we should just start, like, what was the motivation? Was this something you always had planned as a kid to start doing and just fall in your lap, or what's up?
No, you forgot the part about me working at a cubicle and in the business world for 20 years. But oh. Yeah, kind of like, you know, I've always written a little bit, but I was, you know, not a great student. I wasn't really kind of coherent about or consistent about my practices. You know, I like to write and express myself, but I was not Dear Diary writing in journal. It was just like in the 80s when you had to pick up a pen and do that. Mm. It was a little bit too much work. I actually like learned how to use a computer. Like, we had typing classes in the eighth grade in like 1985 or whatever it was. And so, yeah, I always kind of wrote a little bit, you know, wrote for my like elementary school newspaper. I think the first thing I ever wrote at all or about sports was I want to say it was like the winter of 1982, because I think the Bengals and the 49ers were in the Super Bowl. It snowed a lot. And then my fourth grade class was overcome with this huge chess craze. So my first sports article is about the chess craze of Blair Mill Elementary in Pennsylvania, that because I was super into it too. Sure. And then, you know, like from there, just like a little bit of high school newspaper, a little bit of college newspaper, like, you know, we didn't have blogs back then. So it wasn't as easy to do, I think, now. I mean, it's easier to get distracted now, I think, but it's easier to actually like pen down your thoughts. And obviously going like in far in the other direction, we know that, you know, people will talk about how many times they sneeze on TikTok today and, you know, whatever else they think is interesting. And so, you know, obviously we're in a different era completely, but I just kind of wrote along the way and always had thoughts. And, you know, I got out of college and I guess I intended to major in journalism when I got there, but I switched colleges and it just kind of went a different direction. So I had, you know, in the 90s, I got out of college in 1994, working in the business world for a while, worked in financial services. And like, I sold everything from like, originally I was working for a bank and then I, you know, sold stocks and bonds and mutual funds and currencies and dabbled in IT for a while and then got back to sales. And along the way I did kind of like 90s things. Like, you know, when it was cool to have, I don't know if you know what a zine is, but like I had a zine. Like a zine was like in the 90s where you and your friends kind of publish your own newspaper. Okay. So prelude to a blog. We actually like had a local printer that had newspaper paper and we'd write about bands and get into shows for free and review albums and stuff like that. That was what zines were about. Tower Records used to have a whole like wing of their huge magazine section that was dedicated to zines. You know, a lot of it was like punk rock type of zines. Obviously there weren't zines about golf, I don't think, or, you know, conservative politics. So it was pretty much the punk scene and the indie rock scene. So we did that and, you know, did that for a while. And then around 2000, when, you know, people started putting up their own websites, it wasn't that hard to do that. You know, I bought Dreamweaver in a box and put up my own music website. And then kind of fast forward to 2007, 2008, I'm working for an insurance company, kind of doing sales again. And, you know, just trying to stay sane. You know, I was like a young parent. I had a 2-year-old at the time. And a friend of mine suggested you should write a blog. So I just kind of went with that and would do a rant about sports once or twice a week and get my 8 friends at home to read it. And then just from there, set some goals like, yeah, maybe I can get published in the next 5 years or let's see where this goes. And, you know, one thing I'll say about the business world, even if you're not like a businessy type of person, you do learn certain skills, like, you know, things that you think only matter in that realm, like following up and, you know, things that like help you pitch an editor and not feel beat down when they say no. So I just kind of used that and came up with ideas and made connections and eventually found my way to writing my first ESPN article about extreme sports in July of 2011. And just kind of hopped from opportunity to opportunity from there and, you know, never took no for an answer, never decided that I only wanted to write about pro sports or I only wanted to write about the NFL. Like if there was a, you know, I don't know, squirrel log tossing on ESPN, I would write about it, you know, just kind of get something in ESPN, sure. Treat it like it was the most interesting thing in the world. And, you know, I could tell you the story, but from there, just I ended up here kind of, you know, interviewing athletes that some you've never heard of before. But then I've got to interview some big names like Tom Brady and Shaq and Billie Jean King, and just kind of built up, you know, now maybe not, I don't think I have a lot of followers or a huge audience, but kind of a repertoire, a reputation with sort of the publicists in the sports business space. And I've gotten to do a lot of cool things because of it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, based on what you just said, that's a very interesting story. You know, you kind of seems like you kind of saw the patterns of things. You know, you started small, kind of worked your way up, and you just took a chance on things. And that's very bold. It's very bold moves. So, you know, like you said, you were working in insurance for a while, then you decided to go ahead and just try this blog thing and the zine thing all at the same time. But, you know, but it's one of those things that where people are, I feel like, are afraid to take those chances, where that's like, no, I'll just stay on the safe road. And, you know, if I do take this chance, like, who's only going to read it? It's just my 8 friends. It's like you said, I mean, maybe I don't want to do that. Maybe it's just a waste of time. Maybe the juice is not worth the squeeze, you know, but it seems like you just said, nah, fuck that. I'm going to do what I want to do.
Yeah, I think, well, one cool thing about, you hear and read a lot about the gig economy, and it's sort of framed, like, I love business news, and I like to, you know, I watch CNBC and I read Bloomberg and the Wall Street Journal. They all kind of frame the gig economy sometime, you know, probably 90-95% of the time. It's like, well, it's this, you know, you can make money, side hustles, but, you know, unless you're a millionaire, you don't get benefits, you don't get support. But, you know, at the same time, you can work, you know, for a bank and then blog or do a podcast on the side. Doesn't mean you're necessarily going to make a ton of money when you do it, but, you know, at the same time, you can go different ways. And if you do it because you love it, I would say about a writer, people ask me about, like, well, how did you switch to become a full-time writer? Isn't that hard? You know, did you have to starve? And what I would say is, writing is like being a video gamer. Like, no one in the world who plays video games did it because they heard that some esports person is making $1 million, $10 million playing esports. Like, you do video games because you love it, because you can't stop playing. And then if it goes in that direction, or you build up a skill or repertoire, then yeah, it can go to a whole nother level. But you didn't start it because, you know, you wanted to, you thought about the monetary aspect, the career aspect. You just do it because you love it. So I think writing is the same way. Sports writing, I've told, you know, young people that I talk to, you know, who asked me about, like, how'd you do this, or how could I do this? And I just tell them, like, you know, do it because you're passionate, and don't get hung up on, you know, after my first article, I didn't get a full-time job offer from ESPN or Fox Sports. Like, it shouldn't be about that. Make it about what you love and do it anyway. And then good things happen down the road.
Yeah. That was a point I wanted to bring up, that, you know, you seemed to all, even like doing what you loved, you were doing things that were maybe, if you want to say, outside the social norm. I mean, you know, write about punk rock bands, or what'd you say, that you would have wrote about squirrel log tossing or something, that where most people are like, no, I need to write about, you know, the 1996 Bulls or whatever, just because that was in, that was what was happening. But you stay true to your interests. And, you know, like you said, you got to carry or interview some big names now just because of that.
Or, I mean, you can, you know, I live in Chicago here. So, I mean, you can make the goal and say, I want to be, you know, I want to write about the Cubs. And, you know, whether that's you're a beat writer for MLB, or you're writing for, you know, the local newspaper, or, you know, Baseball America or whatever, like, do that. But then don't also say, well, I'm not going to write about Little League baseball. That's beneath me. Or I'm not going to cover this. You know, like, take your opportunities and use it as a means to an end, but enjoy the process and, you know, be honest along the way. That's just my take on it. You know, it's you don't see any. I write a little bit about race car driving. And one thing I've learned about NASCAR is how, and just race car driving in general, like, how entrepreneurial it is. And if you're a race car driver, you don't say, oh, I only want to race in, you know, the NASCAR Cup Series, and I only want to race for a big team like Hendrix or, you know, Joe Gibbs Racing. No, you got to start small, and you got to kind of take your opportunities where you can. And if that means, you know, racing the fourth tier race out in Idaho or Central Iowa to kind of get your wheels broken in, you know, that's what you have to do. If the passion is, your love is really race car driving, and your end goal is to make it all the way, like, you got to do those things, you know, that you need to go down that path. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah. And sometimes I wonder that, and I don't want, you know, I'm generally speaking, of course, that if that's a problem with the modern world, I guess that's to say, or younger generations, is that they think they have to go out and, you know, catch a whale every time in order, if they're starting, whether it be esports and, or, you know, write about the Cubs, like you said, but you know, you got to start somewhere. You got to start small. And not everybody gets that chance to go out and interview Tom Brady or Shaquille O'Neal right out the gate, right? Then you got to work your way to it. But when they don't get, you know, well, I guess what am I trying to say? When they don't get that the very first time, they instantly just say, well, this is not for me. I'll just go ahead and find something else better to do rather than try to work at it and stay interested in it. I mean, is that kind of what the issue is? Like, it's like almost like a victim mentality that, oh, you know, it's woe is me, I guess, kind of thing.
It could be. I'm not very empathetic to people who feel sorry for themselves. Like, I'm not saying I'm great or anything, but, you know, I came to Chicago in 1994. Between 94 and, you know, probably 2016 or 17, like, I didn't have, we used to say the word Rolodex. I didn't have a Rolodex of, you know, important contacts. I didn't have any ins. I didn't have, and not that, I think very few people have like a family connection, but like, if you're thinking that, you need to have like some sort of help, you know, you need someone kind of put in a good word for you, you're focusing on the wrong thing. So I think any pursuit, you know, you got to do it because you love it and not be hung up on sort of what everyone else is doing. You know, it kind of gets the old story in the 90s was, you know, like I heard this statistic a couple of times, kind of changing subjects here, but on any given day in LA, there 96% of the actors and actresses are out of work. Now, I don't know if that, the ones are who are working, the 4% includes the people who are sitting, you know, in the crowd of an infomercial getting paid $50 to be there, or if we're talking like people have series. But the point is, like, you go out to LA because you want to be a you know, a movie writer, script writer, you know, you work on your scripts, but that doesn't mean you can't work for UPS or serve coffee at a restaurant. Like, in my generation, we were kind of told that, well, you're never going to make as much money as your parents. You know, if you try to do something creative, like be a screenwriter or a sports writer or, you know, a musician, you're going to end up, you know, working in the mailroom of some crappy company. And that's all you're going to like. Whereas I think a lot of people, my generation, I'm 50, but Gen X was like, well, screw it. You know, some of it was like, it was kind of cool in the 90s to be a hipster who worked at the UPS and, you know, like had your own brown uniform. And then after your shift, you're going drinking, you know, I don't know, the whiskey that no one else is drinking, mm-hmm. that's cool right now that you never heard of in some Brooklyn bar. But, you know, along the way, I guess maybe I feel like my generation, and maybe I'm speaking to people that I know interact with, like work is a means to an end. I know plenty of people who like are my age or close to who still bartend and still serve at restaurants. And like, that was another thing I was told, like, well, you know, if you don't take school seriously, you're going to be waiting tables for the rest of your life. But yeah. I know people like who love interacting with customers and they don't want to get out of bed before 10 a.m. And they, you know, they like working a 1 to 11 shift and that's their life. And it's very social and they could never work behind a desk, you know, writing like I am or doing data entry. It's work is what you make it. And I think your opportunities are what you make it. And there's nothing, no rule, no substantive rule that says, you know, you can't be a teacher in fourth grade and then also aspire to be an NHL coach, you know, down the road, like, you know, give what you love a chance and keep being positive, I think.
Yeah, you know, I can relate a lot to that. That I grew up in the early, not well, in the 90s and 2000s was like my years. You know, I'm 36. So, but, you know, I remember growing up and going to high school that if you were to say that, hey, to your guidance counselor or teacher or whatever, that, hey, I want to play in the NFL one day or whatever, you were just like, what? What? You're not going to do that. You know, get your degree, go to college and take the safe road out and, you know, go run a business or whatever it is. But, you know, and my point is that Joe Rogan's podcast, Aaron Rodgers actually had the same story too, that where he told his teacher or guidance counselor, whatever it was, that, hey, I'm going to be an NFL quarterback. And they just laughed in his face about it. And they almost just shut his dreams down just because of like, oh, you know, it's like the old story. Well, what, 1% of people actually make it to a professional athlete or whatever the statistic is. But it was like, damn, you know, it can be done. But it's people like that who decide to like kind of just rain on your parade and crush your dreams at a young age. It's just like, what the hell, man? I mean, and when you know that you're there's a chance that anybody can do it, it's just a matter of maybe hard work and a little bit of luck at the same time, you know?
Yeah. And, you know, there's, I listen to a lot of, I'm huge into music and that's part of what my book, 90 Days in the 90s is about. So sometimes I like to pretend in my mind, like I'm like one of my favorite bands when they're just playing small clubs. Cause like, you know, I'm trying to get my book known in Chicago, but not, you know, like I get to interview great people, but it's not like, you know, I'm not like well known as a sports writer, but at the same time, like just have fun doing what you do and don't listen to what people say. And I guess that good things can happen. So yeah, there's a million paths to the end game. And I think it's just, you got to do what you love. You know, so, otherwise, some people just see their job as a 9-to-5 and they just want to make enough money to kind of hang out with their family and their kids and, you know, watch TV. And that's fine too. I'm not criticizing that, but I think life is boring when you just kind of don't aspire to do what you want, whether it's, you know, whether we're talking recreational, professional stuff. It's just, you gotta enjoy life.
Oh, I agree 100%. Who's your favorite band that you're writing about in your book that you're just saying?
Favorite band?
Is that what you just said? You're writing about your favorite band with your book?
Yeah, I've got about 50 of them. So
okay. Or you just put an all conclusive kind of thing all together with them.
Yeah. So my book 90 Days in the 90s is primarily about, it's about a woman who's, you know, about my age. She's a record store owner and she moved back to Chicago. So you see the poster behind me, there's what looks like a train car. We have something called the L here in Chicago where you got different lines, not as big as like New York, but if you ever been to Chicago, like, you know, if you take the train, the red line goes north and south, the blue line goes to the airport, and there's the brown line and the orange line, yada, yada. So, she hears these urban legends about this train called the gray line that supposedly, if you can find it, goes back to the past, and she doesn't really believe it at first, but, taking the whole urban legends as a 90s theme, I kind of play with that. And long story short, she finds a gray line stop under her record store and decides to go back to the 90s to, just kind of like reboot her life and redo some things. And then when she's back in the 90s, she gets way too caught up in the Chicago music scene and, you know, enjoying life and hanging out with her friends and going to see bands play live shows. And she inadvertently gets her job as a music writer back. And, you know, when that happens, when you're talking about the music scene in any city, like, you know, talk with a music nut and, you know, not that they're name dropping bands, but you're going to talk about all kinds of bands and all kinds of, you know, just like a, you talk about fantasy football, you're going to talk with somebody for 15 minutes about football, you're going to hear a million bazillion names of players and coaches and stuff. So I love music from Chicago. I love music from England. I mean, you know, there's some of my favorite bands are from LA too. And so quite a few good bands from Virginia, especially in the like the mid 90s alternative scene, which I could talk about if you want. But
yeah,
it's there's a little bit of sports folklore in my book. And of course, you know, it's right in the middle of when Jordan comes back to the Bulls.
Nice.
And the Bulls dominate the world. And, you know, back in the 90s, like if you see The Last Dance, you might get an inkling of this. But like we literally would stop 3 times a week, whatever we were doing, to watch the Chicago Bulls play.
Sure.
You know, it was
because my thing. Good. I was little. So, yeah. Just, I was, you know, I was like 10 years old. And I was like, oh,
yeah. Bulls. So all that tipping. Yeah, all that's in the book. And, you know, it's just kind of someone's personal journey, but a hell of a lot of Chicago music and sports thrown into it.
Yeah. I mean, so you just decided just to wrap everything up and say, I'm going to write. Is this your first book? It's like, I'm going to write something. Yeah. What's been the writing process been like? I mean, is it something you write every day or you just only write when you get inspired or what?
I think I think some people who maybe aren't professional writers or even people who are writers, aspiring writers, I think that you need to be inspired, inspired, so to speak. But I think you really need to apply yourself. But more than anything, I think, so I spent 5 years writing this book and people might go, wow, 5 years, that's a lot. Ooh, that seems like it's tough. I was really into the subject. I just came up with an idea one day about, yeah, wouldn't it be cool to time travel back to the 90s to see this band that I liked, or to visit this taco shop that I love that's no longer in Chicago because it shut down, you know, 25 years ago. Stuff like that. Like, I get excited about places to go and places to eat, and it's kind of like everyday things like that. I didn't know it was going to take me 5 years. It's not like I said, 5 years from now, I'm going to have a book, but started writing it in the middle of 2017, just trying to figure it out. And I like the subject and the idea enough, and the idea of putting Chicago and music in it enough that I ended up, I just kind of figured this out about a month ago. Like, I ended up creating this alternate reality in the 90s with these cool characters I wanted to hang out with. And that was how I got through like writing 2 hours a day, every day.
Nice.
To get it done. And it made it easier than I thought it would be. But
So what do you mean? Like, you were just kind of like imagining these characters that like you wanted to hang out with all day and you just started writing? Is that kind of?
Yeah, I mean, I knew there was going to be a music piece to it. So when you're writing a novel or any sort of fiction, you got to kind of figure out, like, who's your character? What do they get, you know, excited and bummed out about? Why are they doing what they're doing? Sure. So you kind of figure out those things out. If you got to kind of keep writing in the beginning, but you figure some of those things out. And then, you know, she has a record store. So there's probably going to be some people who are, like, arguing about bands, just like if you're in your fantasy football league, there's probably going to be people arguing about whether your quarterback is better than mine. And, you know, that's kind of like natural everyday stuff. And I just played with that and built on it. And so that's what I mean. Like I would, you know, you got to create scenes in a story. And then I would think of things like, wow, you know, like I think about like my friends who are really into music, who would argue about the most insane things because music is their life. And, you know, how many times I was present for those like silly little discussions and kind of made, you know, kind of took some of that and put my place as like, as a narrator, a bystander watching all this stuff. And I can talk about 90s movies, but there's a piece to it too, where I felt like, you know, kind of like in Pulp Fiction, when you're hanging out with Jules and Vincent on the stakeout in the morning, like I've never been a gangster, but I kind of felt like I'm hanging out with them in that movie. Like there's a lot of 90s movies that are like that. So I kind of aimed for that angle just to be like, you know, you're reading this book and you're rolling with Darby and her friends in the 90s and some funny shit happens. And, you know, hopefully you dig into it as much as they do.
Yeah. I mean, like I love, you know, I don't know how many 90s movies I could just start naming off the top of my head, but I kind of agree though that, you know, that was a lot of my childhood growing up was movies just because I grew up in a very rural area and like literally my best friends were miles and miles away. And yeah, then there was nothing really else to do besides, you know, the closest park was, you know, a couple miles away and it's hard to get in rides or everything. So watching movies was like my thing. It still is. That's kind of what I grew up in. Still doing now that, you know, give me some popcorn and a cherry Coke and I'll watch movies all day long. It's just my thing. And just that you find those movies, like you said, that you're like almost envisioning yourself within that scene or whatever it is. And that it's really cool feeling. And then you can go on and talk about it, you know, and like whatever it is, let's talk about like these insane arguments. It's like you said that, you know, your friends used to have about the most ridiculous things ever about, you know, what was really in the briefcase or not. What is it? You know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, let me ask you. So one of the pivotal movies in the 90s that to me is Dazed and Confused. Have you ever seen Dazed and Confused?
Matthew McConaughey? Yeah.
All right. Yeah. So you know that there's not really a plot. And basically you hang out with these kids from Austin, Texas on the last day of their junior high school for 24 hours.
Sure.
And it happens over the span of a day. And yeah, there's some things that happen. I mean, there is a plot. I can't say there's no plot, but it's not, you know, explosion in the first scene. And it's not like Die Hard where all of a sudden there's a problem that needs to be resolved. Like, I don't even know if there's a problem that needs to be resolved in that movie, but it just works because the dialogue is great and it kind of sets the tone for what it is. And I think now it's a classic. And also it's great that all these people who were nobodies back then, like Matthew McConaughey, Ben Affleck, you know, in indie music, Parker Posey is, you know, indie movies, like Parker Posey is, you know, one of the best actresses out there. Joey Lauren Adams, there's probably a whole bunch that I'm missing that were in that movie. You know, and it kind of works out that this movie that was such a like an enjoyable thing in the 90s became more important as time went on and speaks to maybe the feeling of the 90s. And I kind of wanted to capture that in my book. At least I hope I did. And I think some people who've read it so far have told me that, you know, it's in the right ballpark.
Do you think it's a lot of nostalgia? Because when, you know, we start talking about, you know, movies like this or music, you know, for example, I did a CrossFit competition in Bristol a few weeks ago, and I think sometime this month the Wallflowers are going to be playing down there, and I was like, oh shit, I remember watching their videos, you know, when I was growing up, and it was such like a cool feeling just to even know they were still playing, and I had no clue that, like, it was the first time I even thought about them in years. So do you think that's like a lot of it, just that nostalgia feeling, that people get that feelings back and they want to go explore it and see how they feel now compared to what they did back when they really first saw it?
Yeah.
Anything ready?
I think so. I mean, I know Jacob Dylan's been doing some stuff. Like, I only really like maybe one or two of the Wallflower songs, but like, I love that song, Fifth Avenue Heartbreak. The other stuff is, you know, it's not really my flavor, but he did a documentary about a year and a half ago called Echo in the Valley, where he kind of like revisits the bands in what is that area in LA, the Laurel Canyon area, you know, and like how bands from the late 60s, early 70s, like Crosby, Stills, and Nash, you know, influenced the rock of the 70s, 80s, and 90s. So you know, obviously he's very active in music. I've been going to concerts a lot. So I will say, yes. I mean, it depends what kind of music you're into, but I think nowadays bands, especially bands that have been around for a while, like they don't make their money on selling records. They make it on touring. So I just saw, for example, last Saturday, I saw L7, a great band that first got, you know, kind of heard about in the 90s, all woman band. And they were great. I saw Echo and the Bunnymen, like a late 80s band, about a month ago here in Chicago. Of course, everybody in the crowd was my age. And I took my son, and my son wanted to see Dinosaur Jr. He's 16. So a couple of Fridays ago, we went out, and it was, you know, it was like a lot of dads with 16-year-olds or 18-year-olds. And, you know, they're kind of doing their thing again, and they popped out of the early 90s as well. So I think so. And I, maybe you could be cynical about it, say it's a business thing. Of course, the 90s are going to come back because record companies have records to sell, and people are opportunistic. But I do think that, yeah, people will, you know, Drake will have a comeback in 15 or 20 years. I don't like Drake. I think his music kind of sucks. That's just my opinion. But, you know, like Eminem's still around. He's still kind of doing new things, and he's not going to go away. You know, there's always going to be people who will pay $65 to sit in the stadium and see him, you know, and he's one of those, I mean, it was one of those artists who could probably like play five shows back to back in a stadium. Sure. Whereas a lot of what I'm seeing now, and this is the other side of it, that, you know, like Boy George and Culture Club could come in the US, and there'll be people who are, you know, like 10 years older than me, and maybe some people my age, who will go see them at the Chicago Theater or a club that holds, you know, 400 people, because they're like, yeah, I love their music. You know, that's nostalgia is a big business, but it's also it's part of our lives too, I think.
Well, look at Blink-182. They just announced they were doing another reunion.
Yeah, exactly.
I was trying to get tickets in Charlotte, and ticket prices were insane already just out the gate. And yeah. And that was me sitting with my probably head would be touching the ceiling. They were going to be like $300 or $400. And I was like, damn, I really want to see them, but I can't. I don't know if I can justify this right now. But I get it that everyone just wants to jump back on the board just because of like they're back, you know, just like I got to relive my days.
Yeah, maybe they never went away. I did basically the same thing twice with Guns N' Roses. I saw them at Wrigley a year ago. And then, yeah, I saw them in the Nosebleeds at the United Center in 2017. And like I follow them on Instagram, and like this week they're playing like Santiago, Chile and Buenos Aires. And the stadiums are not any smaller there. They're keeping busy. They're not releasing new records that I know of. But, you know, there's people still want to hear Welcome to the Jungle, and they always will. Even when Axl Rose is in a walker wearing his leather pants, people are going to still pay top dollar to see these guys if they can.
Well, yeah, there's been a bunch of people like that. Wasn't Johnny Cash one of those guys who they would still get out there and just push him out there and just hope that he could play or do something until he just kicked the bucket finally? Like Richard Pryor with his comedy, they did the same thing with him, just kind of willing him out. Because I knew people would still come see him, but were they in the best – was it their best performances? Probably not.
I don't know. I mean, Johnny Cash did an interesting thing where he did a covers album, which I mentioned in my book. I haven't remembered. It's like a compilation where he does like this. He does songs by Soundgarden, Depeche Mode, and you've heard them all.
Yep.
And he kind of like honored and, you know, kind of gave it up for the music of the 90s in the 90s. And people were like, wow, this is pretty cool. And oh, by the way, you know, like people don't like country, like old country. They like old Johnny Cash. They like George Jones in like the late 50s, early 60s, when he basically singing about making moonshine. And that's about it. When he had short hair. Great stuff. Richard Pryor, I don't know. I mean, I guess what we're getting at here is sometime soon Eddie Murphy's going to have a huge ass tour where he's, you know, on stage, maybe doing some of the greatest hits, probably being Eddie Murphy. You know, I'm sure he's maybe gotten a little bored making successful movies and winning Oscars, and he's a stand-up by nature. So I would hope that he's going to come out there at some point soon. And yeah, you and I are going to be, you know, gullible enough to pay $250 a seat to see Eddie Murphy do Eddie Murphy live. Because if James Brown was alive, I would go pay a couple $100 to see James Brown be James Brown on stage. So yeah, there's I think it's natural in American Western culture to kind of, you know, rock and roll was kind of pitched as this thing that was going to go away. And then I think when I was growing up in the 80s and Springsteen was big, and, you know, people were like, oh, no one's really going to care about Springsteen and in the 90s and beyond. But, you know, he played at the Walter Kerr Theater four nights a week in New York for like 2 years. And I remember, I think the first time I went to New York with my wife and kid, my kid is like, oh, we should go see Springsteen. I'm like, dude, you got $1,500? Because I don't. But a lot of people are paying to see him. And what is he? He's doing a podcast with Obama now.
Yeah, like, I've heard that, man.
So like, yeah.
I've heard it fresh, though.
Springsteen's still relevant. Whether or not you like Born in the USA or, you know, Thunder Road or whatever, like, he's doing stuff, and that's pretty cool. So let's hooray for nostalgia, and hooray for people still having good taste for stuff that's, you know, been around for a while.
Yeah. You know, you touched on this earlier that, know, when we were talking about those stupid little arguments that your friends like to have, and you just talked about like modern country versus old country. And then I've had people like, oh, you know, that's not country today, it's pop or whatever. And just, you know, and I really kind of avoid these arguments because I try to see both sides of it, but it's like, well, I mean, I don't really have a dog in the fight anyway, but yeah, but I tend to get in the middle of a bunch of these little arguments like that, you know, especially like the LeBron versus Michael, who's the GOAT and all this, or Kobe's, you can put him in there too. And it's just like, all right, you know, we can sit here and argue this all day, you know, but.
Yeah, one of my best friends she's a college professor. She loves, like, all she listens to is country music. And she's definitely not someone who like is from kind of rural white conservative America. She's from Chicago suburbs here. And I can like, you know, she'll tell you that Little Big Town is country, but they're also pretty pop. They sound a lot like Fleetwood Mac, and they kind of look like Fleetwood Mac a little bit. Sure. But you know, they're selling out stadiums. People love their music. That's kind of all that matters. So yeah. And if I don't like Drake, who cares what I say? You know, Drake is still, I'll always think of him as like a Mouseketeer on the Disney Channel, but you know, he's sell a lot of records, sell a lot of tickets to concerts when he tours. So, you know,
yeah,
more power to him.
What was it like? You know, you seemed like you're always trying to get into concert and stuff. But during COVID, what was it like? You know, did you just have to sit back and just, well, this is how it's going to be and just adapt?
Yeah, I had gone, I think in the summer, I know I went to Riot Fest that summer in 2019, and I'd seen a show or two. And so it's kind of like I tend to do this thing where I'll see a couple of concerts or club shows in a row, and then I'm good for 8 months. So it kind of worked out. I did actually, like, you probably heard that some bands were having like their little tiny desk concerts or like concerts in the basement. I watched a concert. Dressy Bessie is a band from Denver. They're kind of like alternative pop. They're kind of fun, not really heavy music. And I watched them, like the two people, I think it might even be a husband and wife, or the two main people in the band, like in their basement with like a strobe light. Mm-hmm. Just playing their songs. And another one of my favorite Southern rock bands, Dashup Rock. They're from New Orleans. They've been around forever. They did like a crawfish boil and played a concert. Like they're like standing 10 or 15 feet apart. And literally there's like a big ass pot that's, I don't know, it's probably like the size of a garbage can with steam going in the background, because they're getting ready to boil crawfish at the end of their set. And I think I was coming back from, like, I had to do errands. I think my wife sent me on errands. I was like, crap, Dashup Rock is on. I'm literally walking out of the car on my phone. Like, oh, my phone's good enough that I could actually watch this. Mm. And watch their set, you know, walk into my house and sat down. It's probably like 4 p.m. on a Saturday afternoon. So I did, you know, as much of that as I could. I saw Juliana Hatfield play a live set. I'm not sure if she still lives in Boston, but she did kind of her acoustic thing.
Yeah.
Acoustic pouty face, you know, singing sappy, you know, like sappy, like songs about someone who's depressed and the songs still rock. Like a lot of the artists did what they had to. And yeah. So, I mean, I feel like it was obviously a time in history, recent history, that was unique, and obviously you couldn't do anything about it other than just try to be safe. So yeah, I got my fill, kind of gave, well, I guess the difference between the world now and back then is everybody uses Zoom. But maybe, you know, the musicians got out of the program and said, we're going to play a live set on Zoom or Skype or whatever. And that's not abnormal now. And, you know, I'm going to go to live concerts. I'm not going to kind of watch Guns N' Roses play, you know, over Zoom, unless that's the only option. But yeah, for a while it worked. I think it kept us sane for a little while, and it is what it is. So what about you? What did you do when you were locked in?
Well, I mean, honestly, life did not change much for me during COVID. It just really, for me, just go wear a mask if I went outside. Yeah. So I still had access to a gym. I still went to work. I still went to the grocery store. Not much was really closed down in my area. But of course, like, I'm from a very rural area. Mm-hmm. So, but for me, you know, going out, you know, just, it's more just like, hey, you just want to bring over some friends and do anything. And then we'll watch either movies or just whatever, if we could find somebody. Like, I know a couple of comedians did that Zoom thing, and
yeah,
it was just different, you know, like, you know, being at a concert, like you said, being at a concert then watching it through Zoom, it's just a different experience. You know, it's just like, yeah, this is cool and all, but if I was actually at the concert, I would really be just having a time of my life, so to speak. But
yeah, I had friends who got married, and they had a really small part, like literally immediate family, and then a couple of, you know, like a bridal party that was pretty, and we watched their wedding on Zoom. This is in in the fall of 2020. So then when eventually I saw them in person, like this summer or this spring, it was, you know, we knocked back a couple of beers to kind of make up for the the time away. So
no, it was March, I think, of 20. And we, a bunch of my friends and I went up to Roanoke, which was they got a bunch of breweries and stuff up there. And that's when kind of COVID was, I think it was still in China or something. There was maybe one case had just gotten to Seattle or wherever it was at right now. And we were just like, yeah, whatever, what's going to go? No, we weren't taking it serious. We thought it was going to be everything, just like all the other, you know, like swine flu and everything else. Like, it'll just die out, whatever. But we went up there, nothing bad happened or whatever. But I remember like the week, the next week or 2 weeks later, it was all of a sudden the world started shutting down.
Yeah.
I was like, oh shit, maybe we shouldn't have went up there.
Maybe I remember like going out with my wife and a little early, which we tend to do this in Chicago for St. Patrick's Day. And I think it was like, oh, we're going to go out tonight and we're going to have to like probably not go out. Back then it was, no one was wearing masks. It was more like, I'm not going to shake your hand or hug you. I'll give you a fist bump, you know, and we'll be fine. Little did we know, probably about a week and a half. I want to say it was during St. Patrick's Day. It was a Wednesday and my kid was supposed to have spring break starting that Friday. And the Wednesday, just like they literally sent it right home and be like, all right, you got an extra day. And then Chicago went, what do they call it, a shelter in place, and we started going anywhere. And then you wonder if you can you order food, groceries, and you know, we were just super careful and you know, followed the mandates and did what we had to do, but saw through eventually. And I'm glad you know, nobody immediately related to me or that I'm close with got really sick. I mean, so maybe I did something right just being careful.
No, I'm the same way. I have one friend who really put him down, but other than that, it was just, you know, like he just said it was a really bad flu, basically. But you know, no one really had any other bad experiences other than that. So, like you said, pretty grateful for that. But you know, and I also, that might be, I guess, a double-edged sword, because I don't know if I actually took it that serious or not, because I was like, whatever, if I get it, I'll be fine. I ain't worried about it. But and I, you know, and I'm not saying that, you know, to offend anybody or whatever, because I know some people had a lot of issues with it, but yeah, that was just, you know, my take on it, that it's kind of like, whatever, I'll be okay. So I don't know.
Yeah, well, we made it through. So
exactly. So, but Andy, I want to be respectful of your time. I know I only got you for a little bit. So, but if people want to find the book, or if you want to plug the book, or plug where people can find you, find the book, all that good stuff.
Yeah. I mean, if you go to Amazon, if you're on it, everybody's getting it through Amazon these days, you know, 90 days in the 90s. Pretty easy to find. That's one of the cool parts about Amazon. Once your book's on Amazon, it like takes care of the SEO part of it. I went literally from like one day can't even find my own new website for the book to like, oh, there it is. It's all over the place. So yeah, or wherever you buy books, I definitely do encourage, if you got like a local bookstore. And I've actually got my book in some record stores, like, you know, patronize local businesses, even if you have to order it, if that's something you want to do, definitely support local businesses. Otherwise, you go to my website, just 90daysinthe90s.com. If you order it from there, I'll ship it, sign it for you, send you some swag. But yeah, I mean, if you like 90s music at all, or you like a different spin on time travel fiction with a lot of pulp culture in it, I think that's what the book is about. So yeah, it's out there, and you know, take a crack at it.
Cool. Thanks for being here, dude. Appreciate it.
Thanks. Yeah. Thanks for having me on, Chris.
See you, folks. We're out of here.